say right. your name yeah. and your role?
Yeah, Ian Coulson, History and Geography Advisor, Kent County Council. Since 1987, when I started as a teacher advisor for history, and there have been various incarnations of the job since. First question was about the role of the history advisor. What were the priorities in 87? To be honest, the priorities in 87 are very much the same as the priorities today. It's just they're articulated in a different sort of jargon. When I started, the focus was very much on secondary schools because in the mid-80s, there was very little primary history done in primary schools. If you look at the sort of Raspberry Ripple HMI report and the green one that came out in I think about 89, they were saying there was little history of any consequence taking place in primary school. So I was taken on 87 mainly with a secondary focus. The issues at the time were the same as the issues are now. It was failing schools, failing departments, general support for those people who were new into the profession, and helping out those who were developing their curriculum. So it was a very varied job. It's just that it was not as tight as it is now in terms of the business plan. There was no business plan, so you didn't work to a business plan, although the guy I worked for, Paul Hastings, the inspector at the time, had a very clear idea about what he wanted to do and where we were going as a team of two amongst 800 schools, because that was the patch. We didn't use data in the same sort of way, although people did look very carefully at O-level results in those days, CSEs and A-levels. There was a lot less pressure in many respects. There weren't the initiatives, so we were, I wouldn't say that we were initiative free, but you could count them on one hand per year, whereas now, of course, there's a never-ending stream of aspects of the subject which need to be disseminated or data pulled in or whatever. So it was an interesting job amongst a group of interesting schools as well, because in Kent, of course, we have a different school topography. In that we have the selective system still. It was around in 87 when I picked this job up. I taught for 10 years up to that point in both grammar schools and a girls' high school. And one of the things about Kent is that you don't necessarily get the same sort of characteristics that you might find in an area which has gone fully comprehensive. Many parts of Kent in the mid-80s were frighteningly backward, particularly in terms of the high schools. Well, for example, there was one high school which I worked in. I remember talking to the head, and I was saying, what are the kids doing? What's the breadth of their curriculum? Because GCSE was just coming and what have you. And he said, well, when I came here in 85, 86, he said the only science girls did was domestic science. They didn't even have the option to do it. So actually, it was a different environment. And if you go back a further 10 years, back to 74, 75. I remember a head arriving in Ashford. He was telling me, I know because he was my father, he arrived in 74 in a high school and had a staff room revolt when he suggested they introduce O-levels. So when it comes to this business of standards and what children are being entered for and what their expectations are, then over the span of my career, plus a little bit, things really have changed considerably. Although the job, the advisory job, of course, has always been focused, if you're sensible and doing your job properly, it's always focused on children at desks. Mm-hmm. And supporting the teachers. So really, in many respects, the priorities have not altered for me at all.
So was it history and geography when you first started?
No, it was. I taught a little bit of geography to begin with, but I only picked up the geography 4 years ago. So I'm very much a historian. Yeah.
So when you were going into the high schools, that's the secondary modern schools, yeah. Isn't it? Did you find that a lot of them weren't really doing any history on a systematic basis?
Most of them actually were doing history because there was a traditional curriculum map, the nature of the history varied enormously. There were some very interesting courses, and one of the things that my my boss at the time was keen on was the school's history project. And he used to tempt people into doing the school's history project by giving them sets of books and a little bit of support, which is, in the event, was mainly me. So in that respect, there was some interesting stuff going on. When I was first around about, I suppose, the early 80s, there were the CSEs, which, of course, in structure were quite interesting. The last school I taught in, I inherited a CSE group. And, of course, they suffered from the problems of CSE, which was that you had some kids who were at the bottom end of the spectrum in theory, who were doing a limited number of end-of-year exams, you know, the end-of-year 11, but they were writing 25,000 words worth of projects, you know, in every subject in the last two-thirds of the year. So, yes, things have changed, and, of course, the alterations are sometimes dictated, and very much for 14 through to 19, they're dictated by what the exam boards have proposed, what the government has pushed.
So how has your work directly with schools changed since the introduction of the national curriculum in 1990?
In fact, the work with schools hasn't changed at all. In that it's advisory work, it's inspection. What has changed is the way that work has been commissioned and the nature of the work and the priorities that have been set. So in the last 5 years, we've had an increasing emphasis on the business plan for the authority. And we have this huge, you know, 40-page business plan of which we, you know, me as a history advisor, I sit in a particular couple of boxes, so to speak. That wasn't the case 10 years ago. 10 years ago, we were actually on a commercial regime whereby I was bought in. So there was me as the history advisor, and I would be purchased by schools for whatever the schools wanted. And that lasted for four or five years, I think.
That sounds completely different to when you first started in the 80s.
It did indeed. In fact, when I started, I took over from somebody who was actually a teacher of local history in the archives, and that person was relieved of her post, and the inspector at the time was very keen to use me with secondary schools because he was a long time out of the classroom. I think he found some of the work in that respect a bit difficult, and he had senior management responsibilities within the authority. So that was very different. And when I came in, I could almost pick and choose one or two of the aspects of the job, quite legitimately, clear it with him. We were a team of two, and there was much less focus on the sorts of business plans that you have now. There was far less pressure from outside to do things, except, of course, through the exam boards, where the requirements were pretty much cut and dried.
Could I just unpick with you what the different aspects of the job were in the 80s? Because you said you could concentrate on one or two aspects. So if you went through, what were the aspects?
Well, for example, ICT was coming in at the time. Actually, that was one that I really didn't pick up until I felt that we were actually going to make a difference in classrooms with the technology. One of the things I was able to do was to work pretty closely with the Archives Office. And because I've got a fairly broad set of interests, one of the great things about teaching is that when you get into a classroom, when you're starting teaching, and particularly in the 70s, you wrote your own curriculum, give or take. And certainly with the two heads of department I had, I wrote whatever I wanted to do with the children, barring the exam courses. And that meant I could use archive material, I could use museums, I did archaeology, as well as the various types of and approaches to history. So when I came out into the advisory service, there seemed to me to be a gaping hole in terms of archival materials getting out to schools. So I set up a history centre. Now, my boss was very keen on this, and it was a sort of one-stop shop. for history and local history for teachers around the county. And that lasted about six or seven years, I suppose.
What years was the History Centre in operation?
History Centre was 87, it started, and then it ran through to the mid-80s, during which time I was moved 5 times, I think, and we're talking, you know, substantial resources, from five different places.
With the resources I created,
yeah, and in the end I gave up.
It does suggest they weren't giving it any priority.
No, they weren't. It was seen as by the time we got through into the early 90s, it was seen as, you know, sort of Ian's empire. Now, what I wanted to do was to get resources out to people, and it provided a sort of focus, which was, it was a little bit like a teacher's centre for historians.
Because there were teacher centres in the 70s, weren't they, all over the place?
Yes, and into the 80s as well. They disappeared in the late 80s, in fact. They were expensive. I think that was one of the things, of course. They weren't often well used. Sometimes there weren't the resources in them that people needed for everyday bits and pieces. I mean, what I was trying to do was to provide the expertise so somebody could come into me after school. If I was around, we had a photocopier. I spent 18 months actually sorting out materials from the archives office, old photocopies and what have you, with thousands and thousands of these things, and organised them into themes and parishes. So somebody could come in and in half an hour they could leave with 12 maps, 3 sets of directory entries, sometimes some census material, half a dozen odd bits of archive material, and 2 or 3 pages of guidance as to perhaps how to use that. And that was a big thing for me. And when they finally got rid of the physical item, I transferred it online, and I got 200,000 or so from HLF, and created what's now Here's History Kent, which is a website which has sort of taken over the local history resourcing side of things. Now, that is sort of indicative of the way that the work has changed, but it varies very much upon, first of all, how long you've been. I'm a rarity because I've been in the same sort of post for 23 years now, I think, or thereabouts. So there's been continuity, but there's not necessarily been continuity and sympathy from the system I'm working in. And clearly the technologies have changed, the funding has altered. So it was a matter really of taking advantage of what I could at different times. So to begin with, in 87, I could raise money to set up a sort of history centre. By the time we got to the mid-90s, I was able to get enough money through the archives office to set things up online, which I suppose in many respects is a fair reflection of how resourcing has altered and developed.
Was the original centre well used by teachers?
Yeah, it was pretty well used. I had two guys, two unemployables, as they were called, by some of my less generous colleagues. I can't remember who it was, but a guy came in and said, "Look, I've got 2 long-term unemployed. Will you take them?" And I did. And one of them lasted 5 years, and the other one is now still working somewhere, which I shall not mention. But basically, yes, it was well used. The last year, before they closed us down, I made 5,000 from using the room that we had for meetings, and another 5,000 I made from photocopying. So actually, there was some considerable income coming in at the end, because at that point, we were on a bit of a roll. But, you know, that's another story, and that's very particular to me and my patch.
Why do you think there wasn't a sympathy for that approach of, if you like, providing resources for schools?
Well, I think it's always the same, isn't it? I mean, priorities within organisations change and alter. You're extremely lucky if you get an opportunity to run with something that you feel as if is going to make a difference, but isn't necessarily a whole corporate plan. You know, there weren't science centres or anything like that.
No.
I was just lucky at the time to be able to latch into this. There was sympathy amongst some people for a period of time, and then there was no sympathy whatsoever, and that's when it finally went pop.
So we're talking about the early to mid-90s then?
Mid-90s is when it finally disappeared.
So that was when you were working on the commercial model, where schools were
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And how
did
that affect your work?
It was extremely, how can we put it? Well, Kent has been interesting over the last few years. I mean, I've been made redundant 4 times since 87. So I've had the brown envelope 4 times. Now, on each occasion, I've scrabbled back into the system one way or t'other. So we've actually had a series of fairly substantial reviews and restructurings along the way. And of course, with each restructuring, you get a change of approach. And one of the changes of approach was to take this commercial line. I think if you talk to Dale Manham, who's currently in Suffolk as History and Geography Advisor, they're currently running a system whereby he is bought in by the schools. It happened in Kent. We were, I suppose, at the front end of this sort of move towards the commercial commissioning. And it ran at the same time, of course, as GM schools were becoming established. And there was an animosity between the authority and the GM schools. There was a definite series of lines. And the authority, I suppose, was beginning to look at the sort of models that the Conservative government were favouring. And those often, of course, had a commercial angle to them.
Did it change the type of school which asked for your help and also the sort of work you did with
them?
Well,
that's always the case. Whatever the system is, it will skew towards a particular type of school. So, for example, at the moment, I'm doing very little secondary support work because our system is, and this is laid down fairly heavily, that the school improvement partner, who visits the school for 5 days, any secondary school for 5 days in a year, will put together a plan called a SIP, put together a plan and outline how the school is going to be, you know, what support they're going to be looking for. Now, invariably, history and geography fall off the bottom of that list because it's not a major priority for somebody who's looking at everything that a school does. So I've only had 6 or 7 commissions for this last year. Now, previously, of course, when you had the commercial commissioning, you had the schools who were under pressure from the inspection system, who thought, oh, whoops, we need some support here, and we've got to see that we've asked for support, so you get bought in. There were other schools who I'd like to think, of course, had the kids at the front of their thoughts, and they were the ones who wanted to come in, you know, how can you help us improve the curriculum, etc. So it has varied very much according to the management structures, the government initiatives, as well as, of course, anything that I can do off my own bat. And I suppose in some respects you've got to be a bit of a loose cannon, and I think I am probably regarded, certainly by my boss, as being a little bit of a loose cannon. But it does mean that on occasions I can pick up things early, and, you know, if my judgment's right, then I can have run with something such that it offers that extra little bit of support when schools really need it. So at the moment, I've for 2 or 2.5, 3 years, I've been working on projects with the ICT teams. Now, the ICT teams have money, they have local networks, and they have project management to hand.
Are these ICT teams based in the local authority?
They are. They're called hands-on ICT, government-funded, to get ICT happening in schools. Now, I linked in with them because their problem was that they hadn't got the projects that were getting children and teachers motivated. So essentially what I bring in is the death, sex and toilets. So they have the networks, they have the equipment, and I have the death, sex and toilets. And what we've done is, over the last 2 to 3 years, I've provided them with the storyline, with the issues that they can then run with. So very briefly, that supports what the Rose curriculum is now saying out loud in anticipation for 2011. So Uncle Ian, as the loose cannon, has been working with the ICT despite his boss, and we are now at a point where we've got a refined model which is going to be incredibly useful for the primary schools who are changing the way that they're teaching their history in the next few years.
So did you do some research into where things were headed and then set up
being like your good self, you know, yeah. I think you have a rough idea where things are rolling, where things are going, and you can see opportunities which are going to make a difference. And the priority always is to make a difference for children, you know, children must suffer. And if you can do that effectively and efficiently, then you're on to a winner. I mean, with this particular aspect, I've been linking with the ICT, but the main line of what we've been doing has often been literacy, and the history provides the context. And along the way, if you use the jargon of the day, is the excellence and enjoyment. So one of the projects I did was called What Happened to the 238 Tidal Express? Which, of course, yes, it begs the question, what the hell's a 238? What's a Tidal Express? Children say exactly the same sort of thing, and they want to find out. And they pitch in. It was, of course, as you well know, the accident that Dickens was in when he got the 238 train from the Channel Ferry up to London, and it came off the rails at Headcorn because the workman took up the rails on the wrong day. And off it came at 50 miles an hour. And what we did there was the ICT people wanted to basically use video conferencing, and they didn't know how to get people motivated and moving quite. They got some interest, but not a hell of a lot. So I gave them that question. The kids looked at an archive pack. They worked out what happened with the accident from the archive pack. Then we got them to say, right, who would you like to speak to if they could come back? Charles Dickens and the workman who took up the rails. I got two drama students in a sixth form college to dress up as the workman and Charles Dickens. The children, as part of their year five literacy, prepared questions to ask those students. But before the questions got to the students, they came to me. I answered them and gave the answers to the students who were going to do the role play. The children then video conferenced with the actors, so to speak. And of course, it was a They really enjoyed it. It went down like a bomb. It really was exciting for the kids. Particularly, I'll just give you the one lovely instance where one 10-year-old was asking Dickens various questions. She ended up and said, "Now, Mr. Dickens, can you tell me who you were travelling with?" Mr. Dickens said, "Miss Ternan." "Ah, Mr. Dickens, now, can you tell me your relationship with Miss Ternan?" So he had this wonderful exchange between... Now, the thing was, there were all sorts of things happening. And what this represents, of course, is the sort of thing that I've tried to do in my advisory work right the way through the 20-odd years. And that is to use the technology and the subject to get children thinking and writing better, doing the speaking and the listening, etc. So that type of project is the sort of curriculum development which has worked, I think, very well, but it's not necessarily been part of my work regime. It's not quite as legitimate as some of the other items on the business plan, because there's no longer the freedom to freelance in the same way as you could do in the 80s. Certainly in the late 80s, before the national curriculum came in. But some people can manage to do the various projects and look tangentially at how we're working in the subject. And a lot of the encouragement to do that comes through initiatives. And that's one of the other characteristics that you see from the mid 90s onwards, particularly from 97, for obvious reasons, because there's been more money in 3 months of the last 12 years than we saw in the previous 12 years, give or take. Huge amount of money in. And of course, you get these initiatives, and they, of course, can help develop the subject or different, whatever aspects are around about.
That exercise you were talking about with the video conferencing, that was done with primary children?
Primary children, yes. It was 10, 9, 10, 11 year olds.
So have you Are you able to use that across a range of schools, or is it just a one-off?
Yeah, no, we've done that with that. I've used that structure now for over a dozen projects, and what we do is we usually have 60 or 70 children at a time, and they will come. We'll have six from each school, so it's an interesting model. It's not one that I've seen anywhere else, but we started to do this because I'm a great believer in trying to do things with as many people as possible. One of the complications is that you often have initiatives where they're done with two or three pilot schools. They're enthusiasts, so it's no great shakes, you know, trying to get them working on things. It becomes an issue when you've got 10 schools, half of which are not too sure about it, so to speak. So what we do is we get six kids from each school, and we give them have an immersion day with them, and then they go back to their school and they disseminate to their classes, and their whole classes often become involved in the project. So by running something over a 5 or 6 week period, instead of just running it with one school or two classes, you know, two classes of 60-70 kids, we're doing it with 10 schools with 70 kids initially, which can spread out to several hundred beyond that.
So
it's an interesting model.
Yes, the teachers have to follow it up then.
Yes, they follow it up. We have a 5 week structure as such. I'm not entirely sure whether this is relevant to the research you're doing, but we have an immersion day where the kids, the six children and usually one teacher and another adult come along. It's often on a site. So, for example, recently we did Lullingston Villa. So the kids all come to Lullingston Villa. In the morning they have six workshops. In the afternoon they have a session on how to write a story. They're given a title, because I always have titles. This particular one with Lullingston Villa was The Strange Death of Ludicrous Cantiacus. No, he didn't actually exist. But when they visited the villa, there's an amazing body in a lead coffin with various gaming pieces and votive bits and bobs, which completely grabbed the kids, which is the intention, of course. And they had to write the story about what happened, the strange death of Ludicrous. You have the immersion day, then 2 weeks later, a week and a half later, the children video conference with me and they ask questions. That gets them to think about what they know and they don't know. So it marries in with the various educational schemes which say if you do a project 2 or 3 weeks in, reinforce the basics, because then the product at the end will be better informed. The children will then do their writing, their artwork, they will blog, they will put their work up online, they will discuss it with various other adults, and at the end of it we have a half day celebration where the children bring their product, which is the story. They'll read it to each other, you know, we have a little session for that. They'll have another quick song and a dance on whatever they've been looking at. And they have their work up online. So it's a real celebration. So the celebration side builds self-esteem. The ICT allows us to do all sorts of things that we couldn't do between schools and between children. And the history provides that wonderful context, which I, you know, lightly describe as death, sex and toilets. But it's what Ian was saying in the first session this afternoon. You know, I mean, there isn't much that you can't do at a very serious, heavy level with history that can't actually be broken down in many respects to something that is manageable for children of all ages.
Would you say that this has had a real impact on the confidence of primary teachers? I mean, when they go to that, are they impressed and overfaced, or are they lulled into doing some of the same things themselves?
It varies a little bit. I was doing an art and history course yesterday, in fact, and one of the teachers was on our Bairn Abbey project, which is running currently, and her eyes lit up because she's got reluctant writers here who are really grabbed by the whole project. Bairn Abbey, it was the mystery of the missing relic, and we had them on site at Bairn Abbey for a full day, you know, and they've obviously been completely grabbed by it. And the good thing is that you know, one is they're wanting to be historians and archaeologists, which is wonderful, but the other side of it is that their writing's improving. So rather than spending 8 weeks doing apostrophes, which they then immediately forget because it's not set for any purpose sometimes, they're doing something, and we've got the evidence that shows that their writing levels are going up leaps and bounds in a very short period of time, sometimes two sub-levels if we use the jargon.
Do you run training for teachers as well?
The job has various strands and always has had various strands. On one hand, you are the representative of history on a patch, so you're often a point of contact. Now, your point of contact for people outside of the authority as well as people inside the authority. You're also a point of contact for people who are on the edge of schools, in people like museums and archives, etc. The other thing within the authority is that over the years, the role's changed. So at different times, I've been the inspector. So, I arrive with my bag and what have you. And of course, we were at one stage an Ofsted team. Our curriculum team was an Ofsted team. And we did about 50-odd Ofsted inspections. So there's the inspection element. Now, that inspection element was first of all in terms of the old-fashioned schools inspector of the 70s and the 80s. Then there was the Ofsted inspection side of it, which of course had the legitimacy of a very set regime. Currently, we don't do any Ofsted inspections. My ticket's expired, so to speak, much to the relief of many, I think. But basically now we do reviews. So we're brought in to do the old role of the inspector on the odd occasion. In parallel with that, you are the advisor. And the role of advisor, of course, is to do with being a professional partner. The critical friend, I think, is the rather nauseating phrase that is used. Now, critical friends can be along there when a department is really having difficulty in its floundering, and we may well be looking at issues of competency or even disciplinary issues. So the advisory work can be as sharply focused as that. These days, of course, it's with things like schools in special measures. So at the moment we've got one school in special measures. That's a secondary one. Yeah. So that's one that I'm working with fairly intensively at the moment. The other side of it, of course, is that not only is there the advisory work, but then there's the teacher training side of it. And there you've got what we call CPD, Continuing Professional Development. And that's the sort of traditional courses. Now, over the years, those courses have varied in extent. Currently, they tend to be one-day courses. Primaries attend them. Secondaries tend not to be able to get out quite as much. So the offer at the moment is skewed very much towards the primary schools. In the 90s, there were courses that were funded, extended courses that were funded, called GEST courses, G-E-S-T courses. Don't ask me what that meant, but anyway, they were 20-day, 10-day, and 5-day courses that were run in partnership with the local teacher training college, now Christchurch University. So there's that element of the training. And of course, there are the other bits and pieces, of course, which get tacked on accordingly. I've always done a lot of work with our computer people, ICT, because they've often been wanting contexts for the work that they're doing. And although there seems to be some people's mind there's just a huge gulf between ICT and history, actually we can work very, very effectively together, you know. So there's that side of it. There's work as well, of course, with people who I think by giving time to will be able to give treble the time to schools as a consequence. So it's things like museums. I've worked with the Archaeological Trust in Canterbury for nearly 30 years now. And a lot of the museums as well.
I wanted to ask you actually about museum partnerships. What are the challenges involved in setting up a partnership between school or a group of schools and a museum?
Well, first of all, it's staffing. It depends, one, as to whether there's any staff there. The second thing is dependent upon the management within the museum as to whether they feel it's a priority. And also, of course, the third thing is whether the person's actually taught before or not. Because it's a real issue about people who go into museum and heritage education who've not actually taught in a classroom for any length of time. Now, there are some naturals. You know, you can get somebody off, you know, some people off the street could teach, you know, wonderfully well. But it does help enormously if people have an idea as to how things work in a classroom, because that means that the provision is much better if they've got that background. So, for example, we have one very good museum educator, Kim Norton at Dover Museum. Now, Kim, bit like myself really, isn't bothered as to whether it's one person or 250. If it's 250, we're both a little happier with things. So we had 110 kids, for example, in one of their galleries at the beginning of this year. And Kim's an absolute delight to work with because she's very carefully attuned to what schools want, and she uses the approaches and she puts the hours in as well. Now that's great. Where you've got that, you can have really good museum partnerships. Although what tends to happen there is the people who are doing the museum work don't have the spare capacity to do development work. So when the funding comes out from MLA, and the Museums and Libraries and Archives, I think they're just called the ML now or something, when the funding comes out, actually some of the best places are so busy with their programs that they don't get a chance to. One or two other museums, there's the issue about, you know, one museum officer spends a hell of a lot of time working with one or two schools. And to be honest, it's a case of the impact. What is the impact over a period of time? Sustainability is a word which is oft times used. And one of the reasons is that it encompasses something that's really important, and that is investing in something such that you have a kickback over a long period of time rather than something that is just as a one-off. Now,
I was going to ask you actually about the spread of schools that participate in the exercises you were talking about, and also museums. Do you find that some schools do a lot and some schools just don't?
Some schools just don't. There is an issue at the moment about risk assessment. There's a lot of people, I mean, we have a cultural problem, and it is a problem, I think, and that is this whole business about risk aversion. It's also about some of the messages that are given to children and to parents about what actual risks exist. I suppose, you know, you look at the stranger danger issue, and we have schools that are, after Dunblane and such events, you know, terrible that they were, are all locked up, and you've got fences here and goodness knows what else, and children are warned against stranger danger, where actually I think the stats tell us that well into the 90th percentile point, it's people at home that are the issue, not strangers. Now, I think that culture of worry about the welfare of children has extended most obviously with the requirement to do risk assessments over the last 10 years. And a lot of teachers are now holding their hands up and saying, not for me. I'm not putting myself out doing stuff that I'm not paid for, and then not being supported by an authority or a school in the event of something going wrong. Now, the Learning Outside the Classroom initiative, which has been rumbling through for the last few years, that came to there was a bit of a stutter with that about 2 years ago, because there were two elements within government. One was saying risk assessment, you know, do your risk assessments, etc. And on the other side, it was get the kids out of the classroom. And they weren't, you know, it wasn't joined up thinking, as they say. Now I think people are beginning to work their way through the reluctance to take kids out, and I think more children are being taken out. Certainly on the patch that I work on, there's an increasing number who are getting out and about.
I wondered whether money was an element in this, because there are some poor schools, particularly in the Medway towns, aren't
there? Yes, there are. And of course, one of the things that the Conservative government brought in, I say that just to label it at the beginning, I think probably of the 90s, where they said that you weren't able to take money in for a trip and then use some of that money to give children who are in need a free trip. Okay, the legislation that came in said that you know, you're not allowed to manipulate the money like that, and you're not allowed to pay for the teacher either. So that was another one of those moments where a sort of bureaucratic change, I think, did have an influence on some of those schools on the margins who were either not particularly bothered about it or were looking for an excuse not to do it, because, of course, the responsibility of 180 children hanging off the battlements of the Tower of London is perhaps... So...
Has it become actually more difficult then for schools to make use of museums, trips?
It depends. It is more bureaucratic. It's like this business. If you take a camera with you, you've got to have written permission from the parents to take photographs of the children. If you go out, you've got to do a risk assessment. There's got to be a school policy about visits, which is all, you know, basically sensible stuff. But that does, for some people, create barriers. And it's not unusual for me to bump into people who are saying, no, I'm not doing it, you know, unless somebody is jumping up and down vigorously. However, most teachers, of course, are in there for the children. They know the value of getting children outside of the classroom. And it's fairly clear that the outcomes in terms of children doing things better, being more interested, being more motivated, getting the children out does make a big difference.
Can I just ask you about the ICT development?
Mm-hmm.
Because you said to me that you waited until you felt that you really would be able to make an impact through ICT. So at what point did that come where you felt, yeah, the technology is good enough and the schools are equipped well enough for us to make an impact?
The impact came, I suppose, when I could see what we could do with the stuff, with the equipment. And to begin with, there was a lot of sort of, a computer. One of the first activities I was involved with, which was probably about 86, 87, Guy said, we've got these BBCBs, we're not too sure what to do with them, and we'd like to do something with data. So I said, oh, well, that's okay. How about the Armada? We take the data for the Armada, for the English fleet and the Spanish fleet, and we ask the question, which of the fleets had the largest ships? Could we prove or disprove the myth or the story that it was the brave little English ships that sat off from the Armada and used their guns rather than boarding? And what we did there was to take the data and manipulate it on the computer. Now, that was, I think, probably the first of the projects that I was involved with, because we had children who were saying, they've got the same number of soldiers in each fleet, so they're anticipating probably boarding. And there were various other bits and pieces about the tonnage of the ships. So that was where really I felt, this is working, this is going to work reasonably well.
What date was that when you actually
That must have been 86, 87.
Quite
I would
early
have heard.
On then?
Fairly early on,
at
yeah.
At that stage, most classrooms would have had one computer in maximum.
Ooh, if you were very lucky. Yeah, if you were very lucky. And then it moved on, of course, at speed. And one of the things about the History Centre was that we were very, very early on, we were on a web. We were on an internet. There was a school in Swadelands where there was a guy who was heavily into it, and somebody I was working with. Essentially, we had a sort of web set up that looked a bit like teletext, and didn't work very well.
Local network,
yeah, and that was interesting, and of course that prompted with me, well, what could we do with this sort of thing? And eventually, of course, by the time we get into the early 90s, the potential of the internet is beginning to show the sorts of things that you've got on your IHR website now are the sorts of things that, you know, in terms of potential I was thinking about and lots of other people were thinking about. So the web research side of things. There are, of course, there's the media, which is, you know, the media that's available now is just fantastic. There's all sorts of programs, some of which are dire, some of which are very good, simulation programs. You know, things like the, let's think of one, BBC Archaeology used to have one running a few years ago. I don't know whether it's still up on the site, where you were given a sum of money and you were the time team. And you had to allot your money as to how much preliminary excavation you did, how many trial trenches, how much it cost for your main excavation at the end of it. You know, you planned out your dig and you manipulated your monies. Now, that was a fantastic exercise. And that sort of thing has emerged over time.
Is it your impression that teachers today in primary and secondary have totally accepted the technology, that they're happy with computers?
Yes, they've got to be. I mean, nearly everybody, of course, has a whiteboard in the primary schools I visit now, and in secondary schools pretty much everybody's got a projector or a whiteboard. So yes, I mean there's a concern sometimes about, you know, how it works. Some people are much better than others, but yes, the ICT, it's one of the differences that you'll see if you go to, say, somewhere like France, where there the technology, you know, extends to a bit of chalk. Not much further in some places. I think it's changing now over the last couple of years, but certainly four years ago, to try and get anything going across the channel. Of course, our proximity to the channel means that we're often looking for this. So it was very difficult because the schools on the other side were just not using technology to the same extent.
Since 1994, you've been an inspector as well.
Yeah.
Can you just talk about that side of the work?
Mm-hmm.
Does it sometimes conflict with your supportive role?
Yes, it's a difficult one, that. I became an inspector when my boss retired, and it was at the time when Ofsted inspections were coming in. Now, we decided as an authority that it wasn't financially viable to have an inspection team and to inspect anywhere other than the locality, because if you go away, you know, it costs an arm and a leg. And because we've got set costs, you know, we're pretty expensive compared with freelancers sometimes. So the decision was to have a team. The reason for the team was, I mean, partly so that we knew the system. It's a bit like, you know, you teach an exam syllabus and what you do is you mark for a year or two to find out how it really works. The other side of it, of course, was the credibility element, because if you had your Ofsted ticket, then people knew that you knew the system. And of course, we had a fair number of schools in special measures. There was a lot of pressure on a lot of schools, particularly bearing in mind, of course, we've got a lot of secondary schools. A good number of them sit at the bottom of a pecking order, and being Ofsted inspector made a bit of difference on that count. It did make it difficult because, you know, there were occasions when you went into a school, and actually we put Thamesmead, for an example, was a school which I'd supported. I went in with the Ofsted team, and we put the school into special measures. You know, we had several women on the Ofsted team who were getting bounced around in the corridors, you know, which was not good, apart from all other matters, and kids' standards and goodness knows what else. Now, that was obviously interesting, because what you had was then the same inspection team that was your advisory team. Now, some people reacted to that fairly calmly, sensibly, and appropriately, perhaps. Other people, of course, felt that there were axes being ground, and, you know, it's very, very difficult anyway when you're involved in such thing. I mean, I got my comeuppance because the head said, because I'd been working and doing a lot on teaching and learning, you know, because there was a guy in there who was not perhaps getting the kids as enthralled as they should have been. And we did the inspection. He said, "Oh, right." After the inspection, he said, "Well, will you come and do a day with the staff on teaching and learning?" And I think it's the most terrifying inset day I've ever done. So it was 3 weeks after we put them into special measures, and there was me, 9:30 till 4 o'clock, and I remember thinking, at about quarter to ten, that I'd only got 6 1/4 hours to go. But I'm glad to say it went all right. But, yes, the point that you're making, there were issues about this, and it was stopped in the end. You weren't encouraged to do your own locality. But that was after we'd done 40 or so inspections, 40, 50 inspections on our own patch.
Did you discover that some of the places that you'd worked with supportively had not been taking your advice when you were
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them use the Italian management technique, you know, which is shake Ian's hand, give him a cup of tea, give him a biscuit, you know, listen to what he has to say, take him to the front door, wave him goodbye and ignore him. Yeah, I mean, there are instances, this is not going to go too public, but there are instances where I've been supporting some members of staff for 15, 17 years. One of them's at this conference, I think. Now, there are moments when, you know, jokingly I've slapped my card on the table and said, you know, I've now written this guy's GCSEs, A-level, Key Stage 3 scheme of work with him, with ASTs helping out, advanced skills teachers, and goodness knows what else. And these are people who sometimes are just on the edge of competence. Mm-hmm. Nice, often very, very pleasant people who just have difficulty with the job. And of course, there are moments, and this is one of the difficulties always with advisory work, and particularly with the inspector's role, you've got to decide where you put the line in the sand. And you've got to be very clear about the difference between competence and disciplinary. You know, competence is can't do, won't do. Sorry, disciplinary is can't do, won't do. And competence is can't do, therefore support must follow. And if they still can't manage it to an adequate level, and that I define as, do I want my son in the back of this classroom for a year?
That's quite a high standard then.
I'm afraid so, but, you know, these kids are other people's children, and we can't have them being mucked around with. And as a consequence, there are moments when you have to be hard, and you have to be clear about what needs to be done. And I suppose it's a sort of management, middle management, which, you know, a lot of us are paid for, and which occasionally we have to exercise what we're actually given the pennies for, and that is to take the responsibility of making decisions. Never easy.
So you would do a report to the head on somebody like that?
Yes, on that.
Appropriate,
that's right. It would be, for example, it would be called in, there's an issue. We'll have an agenda for trying to work out exactly what the issue is, then we'll work out a training regime, and then we'll have some observations and some more work, and then if things still aren't improving, then the head will decide which line to go down. So it is very harsh. I mean, on Tuesday I saw a lesson, it was a geography lesson, which actually was unsatisfactory, and it was the third unsatisfactory lesson out of four that this person had given. They're in their early to mid 50s and quite clearly floundering in a very difficult school. But, you know, there is a point at which you've got to make these decisions, but the big thing for me is always, you know, help them out as much as you can. That's because the aim is to get things happening with the children, and there are various ways we can get there, and as long as people are open to, you know, common sense approaches, and they put a bit of time in, and they take stuff off the shelf which is already there, and you know, if there's willing there, then clearly that makes a big difference. But it's one of those things about people management, and I don't think it's much different in any profession.
But would you say, I want to ask you, overall in the past 25 years, has history teaching been getting better?
Yes.
Kent,
yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yes, the reason I only have 7 commissions, of course, is that I've been in the job for 23 years and standards are enormously high. It varies, of course, very much as to who is where. You know, you can have some schools who've had fantastic newly qualified teachers, and they go within 2 years, but they've left behind a huge legacy. There are other people who've been there for donkey's years and are still having difficulty in combing their hair. The standard overall, I think, when I started teaching, in 77 in a grammar school, and I remember specifically asking, when do you start getting the kids to write essays? And the head of department said, because it was the one of the questions I prepared for the end of the interview, you know, what questions would you like to ask? And the head of department said, at all level. So extended writing was really not self-consciously encouraged until then. Now, there are some schools where there's some really good extended writing going on in primary schools, let alone in secondary schools. There are other places, of course, where you have this terrible curriculum mush that Ian Luff was talking about, where you have disastrous schemes of work, which, of course, are the initiative of a senior management team sometimes who are looking for a quick fix. I get very cross when I find any regime that is intellectually bankrupt, and I have to say that there's an increasing number of them kicking around at the moment. Has it improved? If we were to look at, I would say this, wouldn't I? But if we were to look at some of the textbooks that are flying around, enormously more sophisticated than they were in the past. I mean, the area I worked in, I suppose, most in the early 90s was in the history of medicine, which was the sort of Brodelian course at GCSE. In other words, we were doing the Lagiri over time. I mean, there weren't many university courses, certainly my university course, never even broached this sort of issue of different ways of looking at the past. And that's where Schools History Project was always going to be my nesting place, because we have development studies, deaf studies, contemporary history, and local history. Now, those are the four approaches which I think are motivating, in that they give variety and they give breadth. And of course, they encourage you into different little pockets of intellectual rigor. You know, if you're looking at medicine over time, you're looking at the issue of change, and you're looking at factors and the manipulation thereof in very broad and diverse contexts. Now, that's heavy stuff, but that's great stuff.
Do you find the secondary moderns like that as well?
Yep. If you've got the right teacher, they pick the right course, that's good news.
And are more of them doing SHP than when you first came?
Have you been an
evangelist for it?
Yes, of course I have, yes. I mean, I always promote it. There are some people, though, who will not pick it up because their interests lie in different areas, and I'll leave the choices obviously with them. An issue recently, a school that's just gone into special measures, is moving from SHP in September to a modern world course. Now, modern world history at GCSE is neither modern nor world. Okay? It's the middle of the 20th century, and it's Western Europe largely. Sometimes a little bit of China and what have you, but essentially it's a dog's dinner of a course to a large extent. Now, they're moving from SHP to that. So I asked them why. And I said, have you cleared it with your senior management team? And what books are you using? Now, in this instance, not only were they changing, there was no school policy about whether this should be endorsed or not. They hadn't considered the issue of girls, because peace war in a modern world history course often does not go down well with girls. Just a fact. And they were looking at books which I wouldn't use to keep the corner of the bed up. Let alone, you know, used with a bunch of children. So there were one or two little questions that needed to be asked there. But you see, this was a school which previously we'd moved over to SHP and had actually, at one stage about 10 years ago, had a couple of young, really vigorous, enthusiastic teachers who made it zing. Now, my concern always is outcome. Whatever it is, what is the outcome going to be? Now, if I feel that the outcome is going to be better for the children because they're doing modern world with teachers who are hugely committed and fantastically well briefed and sorted out, then let them run with it. If not, if we're doing a sort of patch up, I'm going to say, right, SHP. But actually the thing about the SHP is that it is, and you may find this when you talk to other people, is for many people it's actually one of the most difficult things that they've done in their professional life in terms of history, because they're faced with having to teach a series of approaches which actually they were probably not self-consciously taught when they were at university. I certainly wasn't. So great believer in it. I think it's really important, and I hope that session that you saw this afternoon illustrates the fact that what we try and do is to be intellectually rigorous, but to transfer that into a form that gets children manipulating those really difficult issues. It's like the thing that that Ian did with the Reichstag, you know, those three groups there. I mean, I think we could both sit down and now, you know, in broad terms, say exactly what happened in the Reichstag. And that, of course, is a fantastic starter for children, because it means that you can then get them onto the more difficult levels. You can get them onto the sophisticated thought. So that's, I mean, that illustrates a number of points, but it illustrates, I suppose, what's behind the reason why I teach, is that I don't want children to be little historians, you know. My goodness, can you imagine them all turning out like David Cannadine? Oh, sorry. I'll apologise to the man later over a glass of something. But the point about it is that you're trying to, for me, and for a lot of teachers, I think, and I always promote this pretty hard, is I'm trying to get children to be thinkers. I don't want children leaving school at the age of 16 voting for funny little men with moustaches who do that, you know. That for me is a horror story. And so what I want are children who are able to think and make judgments. I do history because I'm a geek when it comes to history. I'm an anorak, right? You know, I've got all sorts of problems in terms of my interests in the subject. But when it comes down to it, there are very few other curriculum areas which actually look in such detail, other than English literature perhaps, at why people do things, the passages of events, making judgments about things, trying to understand why things have happened. And so there are the two elements. One, history is good for you, and two, it's a thinking subject. What I normally say, just to tie this up, what I normally say to primary school teachers who often haven't done any history since the age of 13 or 14, when I'm introducing what we're doing and why we're doing, I say, you know, why are we doing this? What is the purpose? And I ask them a question. I say, how long does it take a sophisticated European democracy to descend into dictatorship? In years, please. You got 30 seconds to talk with your neighbour about this and give me the answer. Of course, it's Germany. And it was 4 years, 29, coming back into the fold. Everything was Stresemann, etc. You know, big crash. Within 4 years, you've got Hitler, and eventually, of course, 12 million dead Germans and Jews, 65 million people worldwide who are dead. Now, tell me, why is it important to study history and understand people, events, and politics? Sorry, you've just been lectured at. Forgive me.
I wanted to ask you, actually, just thinking about the fact you've got grammar schools in Kent. We've not mentioned them at all. Is there some traditional teaching going on in the grammar schools, or is it progressive?
Or? No, room. Some is progressive, and some is quite traditional. I mean, one of the difficulties I've got at the moment, it's a difficulty within the job, which is a very serious one, is because our commissioning has really changed considerably over the last 3 or 4 years. I'm not getting into schools as much as I would like to. So, in terms of grammar schools, there are one or two grammar schools that are really innovative. Dover Girls Grammar School did a project which they had a display for last week, and it was with CABE and English Heritage, and that's the Council for Architecture and the Built Environment, CABE, English Heritage, Dover Girls Grammar, and the exhibition was called Licking the Stones, and it was an art and history project. So that was run out of Dover Girls Grammar. So there's some great stuff going on there. There are other places where it's dire. You know, you I have to admit, you come across people who talk at the kids. I mean, there's a little less of the reading the lecture notes from 1932 to them, but there are occasions when it is very didactic. Now, sometimes it's it can be brilliant. I mean, I remember doing one Ofsted, and you know, you often come across odd lessons and particularly charismatics. You got a whole conference full of them here, I think, which is great, you know. But I remember going into one lesson, and this guy came in and he started talking. As soon as he came through the door, he sat on the desk and he just talked and told the kids stories. It was basically, it was about the First World War. And then he left at the end of the lesson. And he had them and me completely mesmerized. It was amazing, you know. It was really good stuff. However, it did not conform to the three-part lesson. His assessment for learning would not have gone, you know, the usual sort of thing. But yes, there's quite a difference in some depart between some departments. But you see, they come and go. Good people in grammar schools are often teaching at a very high intellectual level. They're bright people. If they're practical and on the ball, they have a marvellous scenario for doing things, because they can do things with their kids in 10 minutes, which with other kids you couldn't do in 3 days. So yeah, there's some tremendous development going on in some departments, and some fantastic teaching in the grammar schools, the same as there are in the high schools. But it is a varied landscape, and this is always one of the difficulties, I think, about saying, you know, has it got better? It's got better in that there's more people doing primary history than ever before, because there's virtually none done according to HMI before 89. The quality in secondary schools is, I think, very high in some places because of the quality of the materials that people are working with, the opportunities that are offered by the ICT. The initial teacher training in some places is absolutely mesmerising. You know, you talk to Christine Council, I think, amazing stuff that goes on, you know, in her department, and several others kicking around and about. You have conferences like this, which actually now, you know, run for 20-odd years, which is a real focus of for people. So there are new people coming in all the time. It was interesting to note that probably a third of the people in this conference have never been to an SHP conference before, and that of course has been mirrored over the years. So the word from this conference does get out and about, and very often of course that has an effect on raising the quality of what children enjoy in the classroom.
I wanted to ask you, in recent years, new vocational courses have become popular in schools, and in fact they were mentioned in the previous session, especially for the less able students. Yeah. So how has this affected the position of history teaching in the schools you're working with in Kent?
Well, it varies enormously. You find some schools, if you were to take, since we're naming names, if you were to take somewhere like the Cornwallis School, which had a very effective and vigorous head teacher about 15 or 20 years ago, was there for 15 years, established a high school which is good on the curriculum development front. They've got a strong head of department at the moment, and they're doing humanities in Key Stage 3. But because of the strength of the presence of the history department, they've got good take up at Key Stage 4 and at A level. So having a particular type of course doesn't necessarily preclude the health of the subject. One of the aspects of SHP, which has been really important in the last 20 years, in particular since the national curriculum came in, and is that we've always said that it's, you know, history won't survive because it's legislated for. History will survive because it has the best teachers. And actually, according to HMI and Ofsted, we're pretty near the top, both, you know, primary and secondary. The geographers are very near the bottom, both primary and secondary, believe it or not. But anyway, it is this business about the teaching, I think, which makes the difference.
So you don't see that as the vocational courses as a big threat?
I do, actually, yeah, and I think what Ian was talking about as well in Key Stage 3 is a problem. We have got schools where historians are disappearing. But again, it's difficult to pin this down in terms of the data. I'm about to put out, and I'll send you the bits and pieces when I've done it, I'm about to put out a questionnaire. I'm not sure whether to do it now or whether to do it at the beginning of next term. Trying to find out what is happening in terms of the number of people who are finding, you know, their numbers declining. The school I mentioned to you that's in measures with the geography teacher who's having difficulties, not surprisingly, she teaches Key Stage 3. And the impact of that is that they've had no GCSE sets for several years, which means, of course, that they don't have any A-level, because you've got to have a core of kids. And sometimes high schools will bend over backwards to try and get a small A-level set going for the kids, which is not good for them, actually. But it's the nature of small high schools in Kent. So I think, you know, it does vary a little bit. And if you've got strengths in some quarters, weaknesses in others, then it's going to have a knock-on effect. Humanities diploma isn't online yet, so we don't know, you know, people aren't pitching in, so that's the next, well, whether it's a hurdle or the blade of the guillotine, we shall see. The pilot is small scale, it's only 100 schools. Mm. I don't think you can join the pilot very easily. We weren't chosen as one of the geographical areas when the pilot was first set up. And what you've got there, of course, was an instance of, we're going to do a pilot GCSE, what we're going to base it on? Well, of course, it was based very much on SHP principles, not surprisingly. And one of the things you'll find is that, generally speaking, the people who've formed what we have now as the curriculum in various quarters, particularly with the national curriculum, there's usually been a bailout exercise by SHP people at the end. Well, the first time they tried to put an attainment target together, they couldn't do it, so they brought Chris Culpin in. Tim Lomas came in, I think, for the second lot. When you look at the QCA website, Jerome Freeman there is very much an SHP type person, and if you look at the case studies, you'll find a lot of them are SHP. So, you know, there's an issue over children not knowing the chronology, you know, which is fair enough. It's something we've realised over the last 5 or 6 years that, you know, the chronology of, well, adults is pretty bad as well, but they don't get mentioned that often. So there's an issue about chronology. How do you teach children in a short period of time the history of the world, etc., you know? And Ian Dawson was the guy who did the paper. Ian is very much SHP. So that in some quarters causes a little bit of resentment, because they're less so now than there was, but sometimes there were two camps, you know, amongst history teachers, more traditional and not SHP, and then the SHP ones. But I'm glad to say that, generally speaking, partly because of the success of Hodder as a publisher. You talked to Jim Belbin?
Not yet.
You need to see Jim. Because of the quality of the publishing through one company and to a large extent one man. I won't spare his blushes, but you know, he picked up the history and went from being relatively small publisher into the biggest history publisher now, and maintained, I think, you know, quality right the way through. You know, you talk to him about publishing and about books and things getting out on time, and his priority is to get the right thing out at a time that is appropriate, rather than just chucking out a load of tut. So if you want to compare, have a look at the average Fallon's book and have a look at the average Hodder book, and you might find that there's a little bit of a difference, both in terms of activities, approach and intellectual rigour.
Have a look. Thank you very much indeed.